And now it's time
for
the Wild Side
News.
All
right, that our plans work, that our luck holds.
Sydney Wildsmith.
But then sometimes things don't go as planned. Today we bring you two summer features that help you out when the unexpected happens, when your voice of the earth continues, here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
They say the show must go on, and I'm a dedicated believer in that. And this show is going on, albeit a bit later than planned. Stuff happens, and when it does, you need to know what to do. That's what we focus on in today's show. Yesterday, I heard the talk that a whole slew of my friends had been hit by a vicious computer virus that essentially wipes out your operating system. It comes on as a warning that you have a virus and asks if you want to scan and destroy it. Yes or no? Well, in the frenzy and fear of the attack, you click yes. Zap. Goodbye, good day. Hello, hell. It's calling the professionals to restore your information, reformat your drive, and reload all your system and software. Well, yesterday, as I was preparing this show, wham! There was the warning. Thank God my computer wizard, Darwin, had told me to shut the system off immediately, which I did. And then I had the presence of mind to restart in safe mode, and, well, I avoided the huge crash. And then this morning, while I was backing up everything, once again before I finalized the show, I ran into a backup glitch, and then was literally hit by an earthquake, 5.8 in L.A., shook the timbers here in San Diego. Thank God so far their quake seems to have caused only minor damage, knocking cans of corn off a supermarket shelf or two. But wake-up calls, yes, they happen, and it's good to pay attention. So today I feature two segments on what to do when bad luck strikes. Coming up, we learn what to do if you should find yourself face-to-face with a rattlesnake. I have, and I have some sweat-streaming stories to tell about it, but that's for another day. And what to do if, God forbid, you get bitten. And then in segment two, we hear from someone whose passion it is to help find the lost hikers, she and her rescue dog. We hear about their valiant work around the year, in all situations and all conditions. You'll learn what's involved, and there'll be a few surprises. So, not to challenge this moment of peace, let's get started and learn what to do when rattlesnakes bite. One thing that people think about, but that perhaps don't think about as seriously as they might, without overemphasizing it, is the possibility of snake bites. And so, in the interest of public information, we're talking with someone who has real hands-on experience with this. Joining us now from Loma Linda, California, is Dr. Sean Bush, who is a staff emergency physician. He works in emergency rooms, and he deals with snake bites. Dr. Bush, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you very much.
Well, our topic today is going to be snake bites, and apparently you have had some real experience with this. Why don't you, first of all, just kind of give us a background on how it is that you have such an interest and specialization in this area.
Well, I've been fascinated by reptiles all my life. One of my very first pets was a venomous snake, and I was about 5 years old. My grandfather gave it to me, but it wasn't dangerously venomous, but it was a hognose snake, but it was venomous nonetheless, and makes a good story, but it kind of sparked a fascination that lasted my whole life. And now I'm doing emergency medicine up here, and I treat patients for snake bites. We kind of have a lot of snake bites that happen here because we're in an area where urbanization meets the wilderness, you know?
Uh-huh. And that's possibly one of the most dangerous areas. In very many urban and suburban areas, there are snakes.
Absolutely. It is one of the most dangerous areas, you know, deep wilderness areas are not as dangerous, I guess, because people don't get out there as much, I guess present audience excluded. And, you know, the inner cities, there's not quite as many snake bites, of course, because of habitat destruction and there's not as many animals. But right here, out in Southern California, you get a lot of urban sprawl just spreading into wilderness areas, whether it's the mountains or the desert. And that's where a lot of people come in contact with snakes, fortunately and unfortunately.
Well, the statistics are kind of interesting. The American Hiking Society is really focusing on this because they have people who get out into the woods and hit into the trails. They have some interesting statistics. One is that about 75 million people actually head out into the trails in a year. And during that time, there's about 45,000 snake bites. Of those, about 7,000 to 8,000 are venomous. And of those, perhaps there's a dozen deaths per year, deaths being the ultimate fear. So in terms of people going out and thinking if they get bitten by a snake that they're going to die, which is kind of one of the myths, the urban myths, and suburban and rural myths, I guess, quite honestly, the chance of dying from a snake bite are fairly rare.
Sure, sure. It's rare. I mean, in fact, those statistics you quoted are probably a couple of decades old, and nowadays probably fewer than half a dozen people die per year from snake bites, if that many. And I think probably the secret to survival is rapid access to emergency medical care, anti-venom, and state-of-the-art medical care. And so for the hikers, I think that it's important to note that one of the best pieces of first aid that you can have for snake bite is a cell phone. And if you get bitten, call 911, and you'd be surprised at some of the places where we can get you. You know, I volunteer with the Sheriff's Air Rescue here and with San Bernardino County, and we've extracted some people out of some pretty deep wilderness situations, and that cell phone comes in real handy when you're trying to locate somebody on the ground from a helicopter.
Sure, exactly. They can call up and say, "Hey, I see you there. Here I am." Exactly.
Right.
A little later on, we're going to talk about what happens if you get bit. Let's talk about how you can avoid getting bitten. What are some of the things that people should be aware of in terms of trying to avoid being bitten by a snake?
Well, you know, most bites are what I call intentionally interactive, and that means the person's trying to mess with a snake or kill the snake or get too close. And so the vast majority of bites could be avoided if people would just leave the snake alone, you know, don't mess with it. I mean, it's kind of un-American. I mean, isn't there a saying that goes, "Don't tread on me," that kind of rings true for this situation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, so if you just leave them alone and appreciate them from a distance, I mean, that's probably the best thing you can do at prevention. Now, you know, I've treated mountain bikers and rock climbers and people who have been accidentally bitten, you know, it's not their fault. It's not under their control always. You know, you can do some other things too to avoid being bitten. You know, if you go out into the snake's environment, you know, the wilderness, I mean, do things like wear protective clothing, wear boots when you can, put your hand in places where you can't see, obvious things like that.
Mm-hmm. I believe that snakes would have a very difficult time going through a leather boot.
As a matter of fact, we did a study, and small snakes very often, this is not 100%, but small snakes often can't bite through your jeans. Now, on occasion, a big rattlesnake can bite through a leather boot. I've seen it happen, and a fang can certainly penetrate a boot and deliver, a serious envenomation. But that's the exception rather than the rule, and most of the time, well, I mean, you do everything you can to try to avoid getting bitten.
Mm-hmm. So wearing protective clothing is a first layer of defense.
Well, I would say the first layer of defense is just don't mess with the snake.
Good point.
Because they're not out to attack you. They're not trying to eat you, or they don't want to seek a fight with you. I mean, that's a snake's last resort.
Mm-hmm.
So first line of defense is leave alone. And then the next, because they'll more often than not leave you alone in those inadvertent situations when you need some protection. I mean, protective clothing is a good line of defense.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's say you're walking along a trail. And this has happened to me, and I'm telling you, it's a wake-up call. I'm also very cautious. I lived in the desert southwest around Santa Fe and New Mexico, and you had to be aware of rattlers all the time. Anytime you're outdoors, you had to be watching where you were going and being conscious because they blended in so perfectly with the environment, you just you almost couldn't see them.
Sure.
But I found myself any number of times, a few times, where there I was, and I ran across a snake, and then all of a sudden they put on their warning behaviors, which is a variety of things, the rattling, the coiling, the pulling back of the head. If you find yourself in that situation, there's kind of levels of danger. One is just how close you are. Talk about the capacity for a snake in that situation to attack. What's going to happen depending on sort of your proximity?
Well, snakes can only strike about a half to maybe up to two-thirds their body length. And out here in Southern California, the biggest snake rarely exceeds 6 feet. So, I mean, if you stay at least 6 feet away, and for most people that's, you know, a couple of big steps back, you're out of the snake strike range. And you can appreciate and enjoy the snake at that distance. You know, they're fascinating animals. They're fun to watch. They're interesting. But they don't move that fast. They can only crawl at a rate of about 2 or 3 miles per hour.
Mm-hmm.
But if you get in their strike range, they can strike extraordinarily fast, much faster than you can pull away.
I believe it's about a 50th of a second. It happens extremely fast.
Yeah, the nerve can't travel to your brain and back, you know, for you to pull your hand away from the snake. Mm-hmm. The snake's got you if you want mm-hmm. to strike at you, if you're in the strike range.
I've been in a couple situations where, for example, I was stepping and literally saw a snake under where I was stepping, and my reaction just literally, I just leapt back reflexively. The snake could have bit me if it wanted to, but it didn't. I think that, and I'm trying to reinforce the point here, that snakes really have no interest in attacking. As a matter of fact, they're probably going to only do that if they sense somehow that you're willfully or even accidentally, but I mean, that they have the sense that something is attacking them.
Right. I mean, striking you, biting you, and making contact with a human is the last thing that a snake wants to do. It's very counterproductive to survival if you're a rattlesnake. So they don't want to do that. In fact, most of the time, if you come across a snake, it'll just freeze. It won't move, and hopefully you'll overlook it. And that's actually what the snake wants to do first, is it wants to be missed. It wants you not to see it. So that's why a lot of snakes have camouflage. And there's other types of snakes, like coral snakes, that are brightly colored, but they have a different message. They want you to think that they're dangerous. But they don't want to make contact. That's the last thing they want to do, because it's counterproductive to their survival.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's say that you find yourself, you're walking along, and suddenly you're aware that there is a snake within striking distance. What's the best thing to do in a point like that?
Well, you know, I think the best thing you do is use common sense and just to stay out of the snake strike range if you can. If you get into the strike range, you know, you got to get out of it. I mean, you just have to get out of it. You can't stay there indefinitely. And sometimes, I mean, I just tell people to step back. If you kind of are deliberate and careful about your movements, a lot of times you can just step right out of a snake strike range. I mean, I've stepped too close to rattlesnakes before, and if you just, you know, step back deliberately and slowly, they probably won't strike you. I mean, there's no guarantees. It is a wild animal, and it is unpredictable. But you have no real option. If you're too close, you need to get farther, you know?
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about what happens if you're unfortunate enough to be bitten by a snake. Now, just because you're bitten by a snake doesn't mean necessarily that it's a venomous snake. I've been bitten by garter snakes and bull snakes, and many of them even act like and imitate rattlers. And I'm telling you, I one time mishandled a snake. Again, I was messing around with a snake, thinking I knew what I was doing, and it bit me, and it coiled up. It shook its tail.
Sure.
Now, I'm thinking it's a rattler, but because of where I was in Minnesota, they didn't have rattlers there. And I just kind of kept watching and hoping I wouldn't swell up. So non-venomous snakes bite as well. But let's say that you are bitten by a snake. Let's talk about some of the things that people should do. And I'm going to preface this by saying that as I've grown up, what I've heard you're supposed to do, this is what I think is common knowledge or belief about what you should do. Number one is tourniquet. Right away, put a tourniquet between the bite and your heart. Number two.
Oh, now see, I got to stop you right there. I just can't even. I can't stand to hear that perpetuated.
Well,
we're
going to destroy this. We're going to totally destroy this. That's why I'm bringing it up, because a lot of people think, oh, that's what I heard. I'm just saying what people have, and I appreciate that. But then the other is to lance and suck out the venom. Let's talk about what you know to be the proper action.
Well, first of all, like you say, not all bites are venomous. There are lots of snakes that sort of resemble rattlesnakes that can be mistaken for rattlesnakes that can and do bite people, like gopher snakes or bull snakes, and they'll imitate and rattle their tail and make a lot of noise. But, you know, here in Southern California, rattlesnake has a very characteristic look and has a blunt tail with a rattle on the end. The tail does not taper like most snakes that aren't dangerous would. And we don't recommend that old stuff from decades ago, the Boy Scouts cut and suck the venom out. First of all, you can't suck the venom out, no matter how hard you suck. And we've experimented with this, and we've even used, this venom sawyer extractor device, and it doesn't work. It doesn't pull venom out, and it can actually make things worse. It can cause damage. And I certainly wouldn't recommend cutting, you know, because you don't know if you're cutting over nerves or arteries or veins or whatever. And tourniquets, you know, those aren't any good either. I mean, it's not good to put a tourniquet on, particularly if you're going to have it on for a prolonged period of time. Now, there's some controversy regarding a technique that they use in Australia called pressure immobilization. And for certain snake bites, like Australian snake bites, there's some benefit because it's going to slow the spread of the venom. But with rattlesnakes, the problem is more related to the local effects, and it can cause such intense local effects that you don't necessarily want to localize it or to keep it from spreading because it can intensify the effects. So, and pressure mobilization is placing an ACE wrap and a splint on it as tight as you would, like a sprain. Mm-hmm. But I would probably reserve that for the very rare snake bite, like a Mojave rattlesnake bite, that where you wouldn't expect there to be local effects or severe local effects, and there might be very severe systemic effects. So for the masses, I wouldn't recommend any first aid. I think the best first aid is calling 911. And if there's question regarding the identity of the snake, a lot of these cell phones have camera phones. And you can take a digital image and your doctor can see right there, is it a gopher snake? Is it a rattlesnake? What is it? Right there on the camera phone. And you can take the picture from at least 6 feet away to keep yourself out of danger. So just another reason to carry your cell phone, especially if it's a camera phone, in your pack. Identification can help. You know, if you're not sure what kind of a snake is, take a picture of it. It may make a difference if it's a gopher snake or a rattlesnake. I mean, that's important to know. And doctors should be able to distinguish a rattlesnake from a gopher snake, for instance. So, but if you don't have a cell phone, I get this question all the time. What if I'm deep in the wilderness, far from medical care? What should I do?
Right, that is kind of the challenge.
And, of course, 911 is optimal if you have that. But if you don't, I mean, you're just going to have to get yourself to medical care, whatever it takes. And, you know, every circumstance is slightly different. I mean, generally, you should hike with a partner if you can. You know, it's kind of like having a dive buddy. Or anytime you go into a wilderness situation, it's better to have, it's better to go more with more than one person. So that in case of a situation like this, you know, if you get snake bitten or whatever, that you can send for help. Or you can be carried to help or whatever it takes. But if you're by yourself and you're bitten by a snake and you don't have a cell phone, I mean, you're faced with no choice but to hike out to get medical care, and that's what you got to do.
What would you recommend people doing specifically in that situation? What actions should they take at that point?
Well, you try to be calm, try not to panic. You can do some things, like if you're bitten on the, if you're bitten anywhere, you can start removing things like rings because you're going to swell up. Snake venom makes you swell. And if you're bitten on the hand, for instance, and your hand swells up, you can't get the ring off. I mean, that kind of creates a tourniquet effect.
Yeah.
So you can remove rings. And basically, the bottom line is just get to medical care.
Mm-hmm. You're basically saying get the help. Get walk your way out.
Well, if that's your only option, first of all, be prudent. You know, carry a cell phone. Go with a partner. And so, if it's your last resort and you have to walk, I mean, that's all, and that's the only choice you have. I mean, you've kind of painted yourself into a circle, you know.
Mm-hmm.
get to medical care is the bottom line, whatever it takes.
Now, from the point that you're bitten by a venomous snake, and we're talking now about this worst-case scenario, or a situation where you're just, you could be in the woods, but you still don't have your cell phone, you got to walk out. What kind of time frame, I realize it varies, but what sort of general time frame do you have before this potentially starts becoming more difficult? And then the second question would be, what are the signs that things are getting out of control?
Well, the time frame is extraordinarily variable. I mean, you could die in minutes or you could die in weeks. It depends on what you die from if it's a fatal snake bite. There have been cases of anaphylaxis, and people are dead within minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you have kidney failure, well, that usually takes a couple of weeks to kill you, untreated.
Mm-hmm.
So it really depends. I mean, the sooner you get to anti-venom, the better. Mm-hmm. The sooner you get to medical treatment, the better you're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how people survive in the United States. It's, like I said, rapid access to medical care and state-of-the-art medical care and anti-venom. IV fluids are helpful. So that's the main thing.
Mm-hmm.
And what was the second part of your question?
What would be signs that things are becoming difficult for you? What would you begin to experience? I realize that varies again, too.
Well,
changes in your mental state, obviously fear is one thing, but I'm talking about perhaps induced by venom, physical feelings of illness or discomfort.
Some of the first things that are very common to happen after snake bite are swelling. You can swell up, and usually it starts at the bite. And moves up the extremity. If you're bitten on the arm and the leg, your arm or your leg will start to swell. You can have bleeding problems. You can have muscle twitching, difficulty breathing, and that's kind of the progression. You can have low blood pressure. It can progress to shock, and so that your brain is not perfused, and you can have some mental status changes associated with that too.
Now, how about ice packs or heat packs or anything like that?
You know, it doesn't work. It doesn't help. In fact, it can cause more problems. I mean, people get overzealous with ice packs, and in days past, they used to recommend, you know, submerging the bitten extremity in ice, and that was called cryotherapy. But then people would get frostbite wounds on top of their snake bite wounds, and you know, two wrongs don't make a right, and people don't get better that way.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't help with the envenomation, and it can cause additional insult to injury. So it's not recommended.
So finally, a person makes it to medical care. What are they looking at that point?
Well, once you get to medical care, you're going to see how the envenomation is progressing, if it's a venomous bite or a dry bite. And then there's anti-venom to be given. You know, for pit viper bites, we use Crofab.
How is that typically administered?
Well, it's given intravenously. You start off with 4 to 6 vials, and you try to get control of the envenomation syndrome. And you want to see if you can stop the envenomation from progressing in terms of swelling and local effects. And then you want to see if you can correct any bleeding abnormalities that a patient might have or any other systemic abnormalities. Mm-hmm. And we follow a patient's labs. And
how long does it usually take before things are stabilized? I realize all of these things are variable, completely variable. And as you say, depending on a person's own sensitivity to the bite, and just there's so many variables. But typically, you know, since you've treated, what, 50 or 60, you say, bites, what is it, per year, is it?
Right.
Yeah. Well, then you have some experience. Give us a sense of, you know, from the time that a person comes into your care, how long do you have to follow this, and kind of what are some of the variables?
Well, I mean, as I said, the sooner you get anti-venom on board, the better. I mean, it progresses over time, and you got, if you get the anti-venom on board, you can usually get things stabilized within 24 hours. But it takes, then you can have recurrence phenomenon, so it can take a couple of weeks for that to clear up. So really, I guess the subacute phase of rattlesnake bite treatment is about 2 weeks or so.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to monitor even longer than that for a full return of function. And sometimes people with really bad bites may not get full function until, you know, up to a year after the snake bite. And some people never regain full function. I mean, a small percentage of patients have permanent disability and permanent sequelae from snake bite, like the loss of a finger or a toe, or the loss of the function of a finger, for instance.
We discussed briefly some of the costs of this. That alone is a good reason to be prepared. Make sure that you go out with your cell phone, properly dressed. Be aware. Don't put your hands in the wrong place. Don't go walking through tall grass. It's just all the common sense things, because quite honestly, the backside of this is what it could cost you for the treatments.
Absolutely. Medicine is expensive, particularly sophisticated medications like anti-venom. I think the cost of pharmacy for Crofab, for instance, is about $1,000 a vial. And our starting dose, as I mentioned, was 4 to 6 vials. And before you get out of the hospital, you may have a dozen vials or more. So that's quite a lot for just the anti-venom. On top of that, you have to have expensive monitoring, and doctors and nursing can be expensive, and other medications possibly like intravenous fluids. You may need ICU care or close observation, lab draws. It's quite expensive. Mm-hmm. Medicine is expensive.
So if you do end up being unfortunate enough to be bitten by a snake, it's going to cost you some dough.
It's going to cost somebody some dough, you know. I mean, we're going to treat everybody. I mean, that's the law. You know, emergency physicians treat anybody who comes. A snake bite is definitely an emergency medical condition. So it's nice if you have insurance. Of course, there's places where people can go where there's other coverage, I guess, like county systems and that sort of thing. But snake bite's an emergency medical condition. You got to seek medical care immediately.
We're talking with Dr. Sean Bush, who's a staff emergency physician. You've also taken this information and made it available to the public through the Animal Planet channel.
Right. I try to talk about, you know, educate people about snake bite as best I can in every forum I can think of or in every forum I'm invited. And one of the places is we had a show. It's rerunning right now. It's called Venom ER, and it's on Animal Planet. In fact, I think the next episode airs this Saturday, April 8th at 1 p.m. It's an interesting show. It basically just chronicles my treatment of patients with venomous bites and stings. And one of the predominant, one of the most dangerous animals in the U.S. of A. is the rattlesnake, and I see a lot of rattlesnake bites.
That'll be this Saturday, April 8th on Animal Planet at 1 p.m. Pacific time. A great chance for us to see you in person.
Right, and if you want to watch more of the episodes, just check the Animal Planet website and do a search for Venom ER.
Terrific. I want to thank you for giving us this extremely useful information. I think it's helped people really realize the best actions if they should be unfortunate enough to find themselves bitten, and also some great preventative measures that they can take so that that never happens or the chance is totally minimized. Dr. Sean Bush, thanks a lot for lending your voice here on the Wild Side News.
Sure thing. I hope it's helpful.
It's all part of being a responsible hiker to enjoy your adventures prepared at all times for the real world of wonders. Well, since you're already thinking about what to do when things go wrong, coming up, you'll learn about those dedicated search and rescue dogs and their owners who are there to find you or your friends and family when something goes wrong on the trail. That's coming up when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sidney Wildsmith.
Next time you find yourself lost on the side of some remote mountainside, just some simple misstep on a path or a misread on a map, and a few moments of confusion and disorientation, and then the realization that you are really lost. As you wander, trying to find your way to discovery back home, your family and friends realize that something is wrong. Search and Rescue heads out to find you, and when they do, they call the experts. Yep, the canine search teams. When they come back, the canine search and rescue dogs here on the Wild Side News.
Now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sidney Wildsmith.
One of the things that fascinates me almost more than anything else, and certainly inspires much of what I do here on the Wild Side News, is the amazing truth about the capabilities of our animal friends. And none touch us more directly, in ways that we sense are profound, personal, and powerful, than the unique bond between humans and dogs. Today we continue to celebrate our canine friends as we talk with Sam High, who is talking to us from Helena, Montana. Sam is a trainer and tracker for the High Country Canine Search and Rescue Dogs team. Sam, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you very much.
Say, if you were to head out on a search and rescue mission today, what would you be looking at in terms of Helena?
As far as, well, terrain, it's mountainous here. We have mountains in the area, or in the state, I guess, up to 10,000 feet or so. We also have flatland in the state, so we can be looking at a variety of different terrains that we might be working in for a search.
Now, of course, that high altitude really affects the type of weather that you have to face in terms of your mission as you head out with your dogs, and we're going to cover that topic in some exciting ways today. What kind of weather conditions do you have to face once in a while?
With the altitudes in the mountains in this state, the weather can change drastically very quickly. So you could be out in a nice 50 or 60 degree day and a storm can move in rather quickly and your temperatures can drop 40 or 50 degrees an hour with rain, snow. So you have to be prepared for any kind of weather when you're out on a search because you never know when you're going to get back in. You could be out for several days or even overnight, and it really pays to be prepared for all different types of weather conditions.
Well, let's talk about the High Country Canine Search and Rescue Dogs. You're involved, you're a dog owner, mm-hmm. you're also a trainer, and one of the things I think the audience would like to know about would be the fact that a lot of people think of search and rescue dogs, and they kind of think about police dogs, but quite honestly, there's a huge difference between the dogs that are trained to work with police and the dogs that you train to help out in search and rescue.
Yes, that's true. A lot of the training is similar, it's just kind of the expected results might be different on the other end. And we look for people who are lost, hunters, hikers, bikers who are out in the mountains or just looking for the outdoor experience and they get turned around and get lost. And our dogs are trained to find them and come back and get us if we're on a wilderness type search and then take us back to that person, whereas a police dog would be more for containment when they find that person. They probably would not come back and get the officer. They would stay with the person they're looking for.
Now, you work strictly at the behest and by request of official search and rescue teams. Is that right?
That's right.
And so you get a call, and then now, one of the amazing things about your particular organization and something that we're certainly going to address today is the fact that you work entirely as a voluntary organization.
That's true.
You don't ask for any dough, do you?
Nope. We try to get donations, and anything that anybody's willing to send our way is much appreciated, but we don't charge for our services to go out on a search. We do request, if possible, that we get reimbursed for maybe our expenses, but we don't charge by the hour or anything like that. It's completely volunteer.
And all the gear and things you have to come up with yourself?
Yes, we purchase all of our own equipment. If we can come up with enough donations, or we're trying to write some grants to get some funding, then we're trying to get the company to be able to buy a lot of our equipment for us. But right now, all the individual members have purchased their own equipment.
Well, actually, I made a little special effort here because I really think that, well, what you do literally saves lives. It really impacts families. It impacts your community. And it also stands as a tribute to what great community efforts people like yourselves can contribute to. And so, actually, I went around and talked to some folks out there who want to help you guys out a little bit. And so I'm going to actually introduce a friend of mine, Angela. Angela, you're with us, I think?
Yes, I am.
Now, Angela, who are you with?
I'm with Talus Navigation's Magellan GPS Consumer Products. And we have a special surprise for you, Sam, and would like to donate four Magellan GPS receivers, our Magellan Explorus 300 and Meridian Platinum. We hope that this, for those instances where people are out there and aren't using a GPS receiver, to help them get back to where they left their car or where the trailhead is, we would love to supply you with that as a tool to help you guys find people and mark where you've already searched. And we know that this will hopefully be a huge contribution, considering that you guys have to pay for everything yourselves, and we really value search and rescue operations all around the country. So we hope this helps.
It will help a great deal. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Angela, tell us how people can also learn more about these. It's a very generous donation, and you're giving 4 units?
Yes.
That's fabulous. Thank you so much.
At www.magellangps.com, you can find out about all of our handheld GPS receivers, Magellan brand, and we also have the vehicle navigation systems. It's a huge advantage to be able to know your location, mark waypoints for where you started and how to get. It'll even give you breadcrumbs to help you get back. Apart from it being something that people use for fun, it's definitely a helpful technology in making sure that you're safe when you go out on trails or on mountains and climbing, biking, as you mentioned, hiking or hunting. So Magellan's definitely always willing to try to help some of the nonprofit organizations and volunteers like yourself.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Angela, so much. That's Angela?
Yes.
With Talus Magellan. You see their products all over. Thank you so much. This is going to definitely help them out. Thanks.
Thank you.
You bet. Here we go. I'm working this board. This is getting tough on me here. Hold on just a second. Sam, let's talk a little bit about, you have to go out and you have to deal with the problems of people who are injured. In some cases, you actually track down folks who have passed away. How do you train people? How do you train dogs to search out these different sort of missions?
Well, it depends on kind of the information that we get at the beginning of a search, but all the different things that we want the dogs to do are just training with different commands, and there's always a reward. Most of the dogs who have the drive that's necessary like their toy. They have a favorite toy, and so we utilize that favorite toy as a reward mechanism for when they do the things that we want them to do correctly. And there's different types of disciplines. We've trained them in tracking, which is on lead. So if we have a known point where a person might have left from and we have some scent articles from that person, we can start them at that area and try to get a direction to travel. And we give them one command for that. If we're not sure or we want to send dogs out ahead of that tracking dog, which are called area dogs or wilderness dogs, then we give them a different command for that, and they're taught to actually go out offline, search areas, help us grid an area. And if they find someone on an air scent, then they will come back and get the handler, give them an alert, and then take them back to the person that they found.
Now, you folks sometimes head out for kind of extended periods of time, don't you?
Yes, we do.
And so you put yourselves at risk as well as the dogs. That's an incredible service. It's just amazing. Actually, I have another person online here who has heard about your mission and would like to talk with you. And this is Frank. Frank, are you there?
Yeah.
Hey, Frank, why don't you tell about yourself and your company and what you'd like to do?
I'm the marketing director for Adventure Medical Kits and one of the co-founders. And what we'd like to do is offer a little support to your organization. And a lot of the people you're going out there to rescue are some of our core users of Adventure Medical Kits, or perhaps should be. Maybe they should have brought one along with them. But we'd like to offer you $500 worth of Adventure Medical Kits products. Your choice, because I know you have a lot of different needs. We have medical kits. We have survival items like emergency bivy sacks, reflective blankets, survival tools, and things like that. So I'd just like to offer our support.
Okay.
Appreciate what you guys do.
Frank, I'll help you follow up on that. And also, Frank, how can people find out more about Adventure Medical Kits, which are the leader in terms of backpacking gear and portable medical gear?
Yeah, you can find out about us at AdventureMedicalKits.com. And we've been supplying the outdoor industry and outdoor users for over 15 years with medical kits. And many of the top guides in the nation, Yosemite Mountain Guides, Exit Mountain Guides, use our products for their trips and expeditions.
Well, Frank, with Adventure Medical Kits, that's a very generous. This is going to help immensely.
All right.
Thanks very much.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Thanks, Frank. Well, that was Frank with Adventure Medical Kits. You see how well this works, the community outreach and the support that we can gain, and it certainly is inspiring that those people involved in the outdoor industries are prepared to help folks like you out. Well, let's continue our discussion. Now, how did you get involved in this, Sam?
Well, we've always had pets, pretty much, and when we lost our last dog, we decided that the next one we had, we wanted to try to do something with, to get a, you know, have a working dog and not just a pet. My husband is formerly involved in law enforcement and has spent a lot of time out on various deals with law enforcement, and so he retired from that, and we decided that we didn't want to just completely retire from everything. We wanted something to do, and since we were going to get another dog, we thought that that might be a good thing to do. So we purchased the dog, and we managed to find the person who trains all of us, Chris Goodhue, who's one of the founders of High Country Canine, and she doesn't live that far from us, and we managed to catch up with her and start training, and it was just one of those bonds that worked out really well, worked really well as a team. There were already a couple of other people that were involved in some of the dog training that we met, and we just really made a great team. We all work really well together, so we have the extra benefit of not just working the dogs, but finding some really great friends, too. And we ended up washing our first dog out. He just didn't have the drive, and so we now have two more that are both certified. My husband has one as well, and that's kind of how we got started.
Now, if a person were interested in joining this search and rescue canine teams, I understand that you offer some excellent training as well. Why don't you tell us about that a little bit? How to find a dog and how to choose a dog, and we don't have a whole lot of time left, but let's try to give an introduction to that.
Okay, well, probably the best thing to do would be to check our website, and it gives all of the different disciplines that you can train the dog in. It also gives our, we do provide seminars that we charge for. We try to keep the charges down as small as we can so that people can afford to come. We're not really in it to, you know, make a ton of money just to pay our expenses and try to gain something, but we also want to keep the cost down so that people can afford it. But you can check that. We have seminars for trailing, wilderness, HRD, water, and our schedule's out on the internet, on our website. As far as picking a dog, we test them when they're 4 weeks old and at 7 weeks old, and they're looking for high-drive dogs that have a lot of ambition and enthusiasm and assertiveness, to some point being stubborn. We kind of like the more stubborn dogs because they're a little harder and a little bit more driven. And there's certain tests that you can do, too. So if anybody's really looking for that, they can get a hold of one of us. Chris Goodhue has tested quite a few dogs, as has Janet Wiltz, and they're both founders of High Country Canine, and they are also listed on our website. So that, send an email or give us a call, and we'd be happy to help them out.
Well, now, where do you want them to send an email? Let's have your web address, and if it's
okay,
a phone number.
highcountry.k9.us.
Okay, you're prepared now to go on out and change the world, knowing what you need to know to survive. That's what we all need to know as our world turns its course into unmapped terrain. I'll bring you the latest and best news and stories about nature and the environment each Tuesday and anytime on the archives. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again when your voice of the earth rings out around the world here on the Wild Side News.